Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 3rd of July, these are our main stories. The grandmother of the teenager whose killing by police sparked nights of riots in France makes an impassioned appeal for calm. Ukraine says Russian forces are advancing in some eastern areas as Kyiv continues its counter-offensive. A spokesman for South Africa's Zulu King dismisses reports that the monarch has been poisoned. Also in this podcast, why a video promoting the Philippines as a tourist destination wasn't quite what it seemed. We begin in France. The grandmother of the 17-year-old whose killing by police has sparked five nights of rioting in France has made an emotional appeal for the violence to stop. Identified only as Nadia, she told French TV channel BFM that she was angry at the policeman who killed her grandson, but not at the police who were trying to stop the unrest. And she called on protesters to stop using Niall's death as an excuse to attack schools and burn cars. President Emmanuel Macron met government ministers on Sunday evening for the latest in a series of crisis meetings, as for the third night running, 45,000 security officers were deployed nationwide. Our correspondent, Regina Vaidyanathan, is in the French capital.
I'm at the Elysee Palace in the centre of Paris, and for a couple of hours this evening, French President Emmanuel Macron was here on a Sunday night holding crisis talks with the Prime Minister, the Interior Minister and the Justice Minister, amongst other top officials. Now, it's quite striking, as I say, on a Sunday evening that he's brought people together to have these talks. It's not the first main talks he's had on this ongoing crisis this week. And really, we still don't see what the political resolution is to this ongoing crisis. Tonight, once again, there are thousands of police officers who are on standby across the country in case of further violence, some 45,000 police officers across the country. It comes after another night of unrest, Saturday into Sunday. Now, about 700 people were arrested last night. That was definitely down from Friday night when their officers said they made around 1,300 arrests. Now, of course, the real challenge is what can be done to contain this ongoing violence. Well, today we heard from some of the family members of 17-year-old Niall. He is the teenager who was shot dead by a police officer, his death sparking those mass protests for days on end now. But tonight, his family are saying that they want calm. They have called for calm. His grandmother, Nadia, spoke to a French channel.
I tell them to stop it. It's mothers who take buses. It's mothers who walk outside. We should calm things. We don't want them to break things. These people should calm down. Niall is dead. That's all there is. And I've lost my daughter. Without her child, I've lost her. It's over. My daughter no longer has a life. It's over, and I understand her. And so, as a grandmother, they took away my daughter and my grandson, both of them. That's it. I'm tired. I can't bear this any longer.
Well, it does feel, in some ways, that the public mood and sympathy and support for the protests is starting to wane when you have people like the family urging the rioters to just stop. We also heard in the last couple of days from personalities like the French football captain Kylian Mbappe telling people that he might sympathise with some of the reasons why they're on the streets, but that doesn't justify violence. Last night, things took a different turn when the home of a mayor in a suburb of France was attacked. Now, he wasn't actually at home at the time. He was at the town hall, but his family, his wife and their young children were at home when a car was rammed into the front of their house and it was set alight. Now, his wife was able to escape with the children. She broke her leg, but it really did kind of, you know, make national headlines here because of the nature of the attack. And Vincent Jeanbrun, the mayor of that suburban municipality, said that he felt that, you know, it'd been a real turning point. Now, he has been speaking to the media for the first time.
Aucun doute sur le fait qu'ils voulaient brûler la maison.
There is no doubt that they wanted to burn the house down, and in fact, from the moment they learnt that there was someone inside, because the lights were on, far from stopping, they unleashed a salvo of mortar fire that was completely crazy. We are very tired, we're exhausted, we're sad, we're angry, we're scared. At the same time, we are still standing. I was just told that my wife's operation was successful and that she will wake up soon, so we are clinging to small victories, small pleasures as they come. I never imagined putting my wife, my children, in danger.
We were there at the house earlier today. There was a police car outside and a police cordon, lots of journalists as well. We spoke to one of the neighbours who said he felt it was time for a state of emergency to be introduced. He said enough is enough, this has to stop. Now, while many people agree with that sentiment, particularly people who are living in areas where shopfronts have been smashed up and things are being set on fire, but you still have a body of people who feel strongly enough to want to protest. Many of them are teenagers. Many of them are angry at what they say is a systemic problem of racism in France's police force, racial profiling and heavy-handedness.
Rajini Vaidyanathan in Paris. Ukraine's deputy defence minister has said Russian troops are advancing in some eastern areas. Hanna Maliar made the comments in a social media post as her country's counter-offensive continues. Rory Gallimore reports.
It's extremely difficult to verify either side's claims of gains in this war, but it's not often that Ukraine makes reference to Russian advances. Hanna Maliar described the fighting everywhere as fierce. She said Moscow's forces were moving forward near the city of Donetsk, as well as two towns further north. However, she also said Ukrainian troops were advancing in some southern areas and around the shattered city of Bakhmut. Any progress in Ukraine's counteroffensive is clearly happening slowly as its troops come up against deeply entrenched Russian defences. On Friday, the most senior military officer in the US said the Ukrainian operation would be very bloody.
Rory Gallimore. An environmental campaign group has said the Anglo-Dutch energy giant Shell is still trading Russian gas more than a year after promising to pull out of the country. Global Witness says Shell handled nearly an eighth of all Russia's liquefied natural gas exports by sea last year and is still shipping tankers laden with Russian gas. An advisor to Ukraine's President Zelensky has accused the company of accepting, quote, blood money. My colleague Paul Henley spoke to Lewis Wilson, head of the Ukraine project for Global Witness.
So we've studied international trade data and we found that Shell has, over the past year or so, continued to trade enormous amounts of Russian gas, what's called LNG. And that is despite a promise Shell made shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine to stop trading what it calls Russian hydrocarbons, so oil and gas. And Shell actually traded 12% of all Russia's gas exports last year. And so they were crucial in an industry that has been central to Putin's war effort.
The trouble you've got is that Shell is not doing anything illegal.
Exactly. And if this were oil, some of these trades would be breaching sanctions, but there's a carve-out in the sanctions for LNG. And Shell has argued that it's doing this for European energy security, but the vast majority of this LNG was actually going to Asia. So Shell really here is profiteering, and we're calling for the trade in Russian LNG to be banned.
Let me read you part of Shell's response to your findings. The company says it stopped buying Russian liquefied natural gas on the spot market, but still has some what it calls long-term contractual commitments. This is in full compliance, it says, with sanctions, applicable laws and regulations of the countries in which we operate. We've been clear about this. It says there is a dilemma between putting pressure on the Russian government over its atrocities in Ukraine and ensuring stable, secure energy supplies. It's for governments to decide on that. It's an incredibly difficult trade-off that must be made. Response.
Well, I'm sure it was incredibly difficult for Shell to make hundreds of millions from the Russian LNG trade, as we estimate that they did last year. I would just point out...
But they're allowed to do that by governments. That's their point.
Absolutely. But Shell were also allowed to trade Russian oil last year. But Shell have set a precedent. In March last year, when they bought an enormous amount of Russian oil on the spot market, they subsequently apologised and gave the profits of that transaction to humanitarian organisations in Ukraine. So there is a precedent here set by Shell that profiteering from Russian oil and gas at a time when Russia is destroying Ukrainian infrastructure, murdering Ukrainian civilians, is wrong. And whether or not certain trades are against the rules, I think we can all agree that they're unethical, they're bad for Ukraine, and they're bad for the planet.
Apart from you, who should be putting pressure on Shell now?
Well, the British government should be putting pressure on Shell, that's clear. The Ukrainian government has done its bit. They're calling on Shell and other oil majors to give the profits of their Russian businesses to reconstruction. But we definitely need to see more action from the British government on this. They've been woefully absent on this issue. And whilst the British government wants to talk a tough game on military aid, it has failed Ukraine on the issue of energy.
Lewis Wilson from Global Witness. Police in the US city of Baltimore are searching for those behind a mass shooting that left two people dead. The victims, an 18-year-old woman and a 20-year-old man, were attending a party in the early hours of Sunday morning when gunfire suddenly erupted. Nearly 30 other people were wounded. Three of them are in a critical condition. The mayor of Baltimore, Brandon Scott, said no stone will be left unturned in the hunt for the killers.
This was the reckless, cowardly act that happened here and that has permanently altered many lives and cost two people their lives. And I want those who are responsible to hear me very clearly. We will not stop until we find you, and we will find you.
Our correspondent in the US, Peter Bowes, told us more about how events unfolded.
It should have been a fun night. It was shortly after midnight, local time, in the Brooklyn Homes neighbourhood of Baltimore when the police responded. They received several calls reporting shots being fired during a large holiday block party at a housing development. It's the July the 4th weekend here in the States, and a barrage of gunfire is how the police described it. The 18-year-old woman that you mentioned, she was found dead at the scene, and the 20-year-old man who was taken to hospital, he later died. Now, local people who were there have been talking about what happened and how there were several false alarms earlier in the evening, people mistaking the sounds of fireworks for gunfire, traditional fireworks, to mark July the 4th, which suggests that there were some tensions around the event. Tragically and historically, this holiday in the US to mark Independence Day has often been marred by incidents like this.
And what's the latest on the search for whoever carried out this attack?
Well, the investigation is ongoing. The police are combing through security video to try to identify suspects. No one has been arrested. No information about the attackers has been released. And there's no word on a possible motive either. And the police say it is an extensive crime scene and that their officers will be there for some time. There's been an angry response from local officials. We've just heard from the mayor. The governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, has also released a statement. He said, Maryland has had enough of watching gun violence continue to ravage our state and our nation. And he says the fact that these horrific shootings continue to take place is abominable.
Peter Bowes. The brightly coloured coral reefs of the Red Sea are an underwater paradise, home to many beautiful fish and a fascinating array of other marine life. But now the mysterious and rapid decline of a key species of sea urchins poses a new threat, sparking fears that this precious habitat will be increasingly choked up by fast-growing green algae. Researchers from Tel Aviv University began noticing the deaths at the start of the year, and since then, vast numbers of black sea urchins have died. Yolande Nell reports.
The soothing sound of waves at Eilat in the north of the Red Sea. But under the water, there's a new threat to the coral reefs here, which teem with life. A deadly epidemic among black sea urchins. It has marine biologists worried. Dr. Omri Bronstein from Tel Aviv University hands me a specimen.
And what I would like to show you is also, we know that the pathogen hurts. The visible signs would be paralysis of the tube feet. Sea urchins walk with tiny little feet, which they call tube feet, and these will get paralyzed. And also their spines, which are very active, and so you'll see their spines simply lying on the side, which makes them very, very vulnerable to predation.
It took just weeks for the spiky black sea urchins to die off from much of the Gulf of Aqaba, where it's a key species. And Omri Omersi from the Israeli National Parks Authority, who dives down to monitor the marine life in Eilat, says its unusual, fast disappearance could have a big impact. The urchins eat sea algae, stopping it from taking over.
Sea algae and corals are always competing for space on the reef. Once sea urchins are gone, the sea algae will spread much faster, and sea algae can spread way faster than corals. Corals, as we know, can grow in average of 1 centimeter a year. Sea algae grow 1 centimeter per day.
Further south, these sea urchins, which used to carpet parts of the reefs, have been dying in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, with one theory that shipping may have helped spread the disease. Dr. Mahmoud Hanafi, an Egyptian marine biologist, says the problem may even extend to the Indian Ocean.
All the areas I surveyed, north of Hurghada until south of Marsa Alam, I couldn't find a single specimen. Just disappeared. In addition, after I received this notification that even Somalia affected by disappearing of the species.
Back in his lab in Tel Aviv, Dr. Bronstein uses an electron microscope to try to identify what's killing the Black Sea urchins. One lead his team has is recent research which identified a waterborne parasite that killed a related species in the Caribbean 40 years ago. Coral reefs there never recovered. But Dr. Bronstein finds something to be positive about in this politically complex region.
We've learned to work better together. And even if nothing or many things don't go public, the distances between Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and further south don't really exist underwater. There's a lot of interest from our neighboring countries and from the Persian Gulf.
Now the wait is on for winter, when algae blooms naturally in the Red Sea. Meanwhile, there are new steps being taken to try to stop overfishing and pollution, which also threaten the coral reefs, along with climate change. While many issues divide the countries along this shoreline, they all share the responsibility to protect these turquoise waters and their impressive array of marine creatures.
That report by Yoland Nell. Still to come.
It's important for me because it helped me calm down my nervous system. You breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth with a whisper to slow your breath down.
We hear from a New York school where mindful breathing is helping to improve the mental health of pupils.
Every weekday morning, wake up with an in-depth look at a single story that's affecting Africa right now.
And every weekday afternoon, wind down with three essential stories from across the continent and hear African perspectives on global news.
That's what you'll get from Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
Two BBC World Service podcasts all about Africa.
And where will they find them, Alan?
Just search for Africa Daily and Focus on Africa wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The Organisation of Islamic Cooperation has called for global action to stop vandalism of the Quran after Sweden's government allowed a protest at which a copy of the Muslim holy book was burnt. At an emergency meeting in the Saudi city of Jeddah, the group said international law must be used to quell religious hatred. Yusuf Taha reports.
The meeting was called by Saudi Arabia in response to the burning of a copy of the Muslim holy book by an Iraqi-born refugee in Sweden last Wednesday, which was the first day of Eid al-Adha. The 57-member organization said there had been 4 instances of Quran burning in Sweden alone, all on the pretext of freedom of expression. It said this despicable act was offensive to the world's 1.8 billion Muslims. The Swedish government said that the protest was an Islamophobic act, adding that it did not reflect its own views.
Yusuf Taha. Now to South Africa, where there's confusion over whether or not the Zulu king has been poisoned, and if he has been, whether or not he's being treated in South Africa or in Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, which is landlocked by South Africa. Initially, the traditional Zulu Prime Minister, Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi, said the king was being treated in Eswatini after the sudden and unexpected death of one of his close advisers. But then that was denied by the king's spokesman, who said he had neither been poisoned nor taken to hospital. So, what's going on? Temes Gendebesai is our Africa regional editor.
News of the king being admitted to hospital first broke on Twitter because the traditional prime minister issued a statement saying that he'd received information from one of the king's brothers that the king had been admitted to hospital for suspected food poisoning. And this comes after one of the king's senior aides died suddenly. So this is what we initially knew. And then after that, we heard later in the day that the royal spokesman came out and denied those claims. He said they were total fabrications. It was a lie and that the king was doing well. He was in great health and that he wasn't admitted to hospital.
But there are reports of increased security at a private hospital in Eswatini.
Yes, that's correct. So after the royal spokesperson came out and denied the earlier statements, we've been hearing that police sources, in fact, in Eswatini, where the king is assumed to be, indicated that there has been heavy security presence at a private hospital, which happens to be very close to the king's residence, the king of Eswatini, that is.
And we don't know if the king's been poisoned or not, but who could possibly be behind this? What are the intrigues that are going on in the royal court?
I think it would be too early to speculate who could be behind it. But obviously, if you look into the royal family itself and the way that the king actually came to the throne, he happens to be one of 28 children that the last king had. The last king, he left 6 wives, and King Misuzulu happens to be one of 28 children, and he is the oldest of the 3rd wife. Now, when King Goodwill, his father, passed away in 2021, it was up to the queen to appoint who the next heir to the throne would be. But she died 7 weeks after the king's death. And at the reading of the will, it turned out that King Misuzulu, the current king, was the one who was chosen to succeed the throne. Now, there was a lot of protests from within the royal family. They were not happy with the decision. And the king had to actually be escorted by a security detail from Eswatini at the time. So there is a lot of rift within the family itself.
Temes Gendebesai. Local leaders in the Orkney Islands, just north of the Scottish mainland, are to discuss alternative forms of governance, including closer links to Norway, Denmark or Iceland, or gaining more autonomy within the United Kingdom. The council that runs the islands says they aren't funded adequately by either the UK or the Scottish government. Katie Hunter from BBC Scotland told us more about the proposals being considered.
Well, this motion has come from Orkney Council leader James Stockin, and he says it's because there are many areas where, in his view, the Scottish and UK governments are failing Orkney dreadfully. And he argues that Orkney doesn't get the same deal as some other Scottish islands. So on Tuesday, councillors will be asked whether they want to explore the possibility of alternative forms of governance. Now, that includes looking at Crown dependencies like the Channel Islands, or perhaps securing a Nordic connection with Denmark or Norway or Iceland. And of course, the Orkney Islands were part of Norway until 1472, when they were handed to Scotland in lieu of a dowry payment for a royal wedding. And Councillor Stockin said Orkney had been part of the Norse Kingdom for much longer than it had been part of the United Kingdom. And he says that all options should be on the table.
On the street in Orkney, people come up to me and say, when are we going back to Norway? There is a huge affinity and a huge deep cultural relationship there. This isn't just flying a kite. This is asking a question that has been asked for all of my life. Is there other opportunities? Being part of the Norse Kingdom for much longer than being part of the United Kingdom in the past, and now with telecommunications or with transport routes, all things are possible.
So, Katie, what's the reaction been?
Well, Scotland's First Minister, Humza Yousaf, was asked about this on Friday, and he said he supported greater autonomy for local authorities, including Orkney, but he didn't go any further than that. The UK government said it was boosting trade and encouraging investment across Scotland, including £50 million to grow the prosperity of Scottish islands. And a spokesperson said there were no plans to change the current devolution settlement. But it's worth emphasising these proposals are absolutely in their infancy, so it'll be up to councillors in Orkney whether to explore these options further. But of course, if they do that, it will take time and money.
Katie Hunter. Staying in the UK, and a more environmentally friendly alternative to burial or traditional cremation is to be offered in the country later this year. Called water cremation or resumation, research suggests the practice is a more sustainable option as it doesn't release toxic gases. Emma Petrie reports.
Resumation uses a mixture of water and potassium hydroxide to break down human remains. The cycle takes 4 hours, after which the bones remain and are powdered down and can be returned to relatives in a similar way to ashes in an urn. There's strong evidence that suggests resumation is a more sustainable option than traditional cremation, which uses a lot of energy and leads to the release of carbon dioxide. The process is used widely in the United States, and the late anti-apartheid campaigner, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, chose the method for his funeral arrangements. The introduction of water cremation will be the first alternative way to dispose of a body in the UK since the introduction of the Cremation Act in 1902.
Emma Petrie. Now to the Philippines. That's a soundtrack from a promotional video advertising the country as a holiday destination. But the slickly produced film has landed the advertising agency that made it in hot water after it emerged that some of the stunning images were actually from other countries. Viv Marsh reports.
The Philippines is a popular tourist destination, renowned for its unspoiled beaches, rich wildlife and breathtaking scenery. Launching a new government advertising drive last week, the Tourism Secretary Cristina Frasco said Love the Philippines was an innovative campaign that would unite Filipinos in promoting their country to the world. The video produced by the DDB advertising agency was certainly innovative. A Philippine blogger and fact-checkers at the French news agency found that it contained numerous images of other countries. The rice terraces shown in the video turned out to be not in the Philippines, but in the Indonesian province of Bali. The rolling sand dunes came from a sequence filmed in the United Arab Emirates. A fisherman casting his net was a stock shot from Thailand. And the aircraft shown touching down was actually landing at Zurich in Switzerland, about 10,000 kilometres away. DDB apologised for what it called an unfortunate oversight. The Philippines Department of Tourism is investigating.
Viv Marsh. In recent days, the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, has announced that children in the city's primary schools will be practising what he calls mindful breathing starting from September. It's part of an initiative which aims to improve the mental health of pupils. Some schools have introduced the idea already. My colleague, Julian Warwicker, spoke to some of those involved. Lena Gates is a principal of Public School No. 5, or PS5, in Brooklyn, New York, and you'll hear her in a moment after three of her pupils, Cash, Sean and Noah.
It's important for me because it helped me calm down my nervous system and it makes me able to focus on more things.
Okay, so you clearly think it's a good thing. Cash, tell me a little bit more about it as well, particularly how you actually do it. What do you do when you do your mindful breathing?
You breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth with a whisper to slow your breath down.
Okay, so that whisper's important, is it? You've got to do it with a whisper.
To slow your breathing down.
Okay, to slow it down. Great, so that gives us a sense of what you do. So, Sean, tell me how it feels when you do it.
It helped me calm down my body. Sometimes I have to do it more than once.
Okay, so you might do it more than once during a school day. Lena, let me bring you in as the principal of the school. Tell me the story behind introducing this idea.
My school decided to introduce and to implement the mindfulness techniques with our students when COVID invaded our space. And one of the things that we noticed when students were working from home, a lot of students were agitated with the process that we were using. We were all on the Zoom method for instruction. So then when the students got back to the building, we had to actually get them ready again because they had been home for such a long time. We had to get them ready for instruction. We had to get students ready to socialize with their peers. And we also had to get students ready to sort of face some of the challenges that they had, things that happened at home, things that happened within their families. So we had to actually get them ready to be able to cope and to handle that. Mindfulness was one of the programs that we decided to use because when students felt like something was happening and they did not understand what was going on with them, we would send them downstairs to the guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor would just have them sit and then start with the mindfulness techniques. And once the students engaged in some of the techniques, they started to calm down. They were able to talk. They were able to talk about things that were bothering them. They were able to then express their feelings. And once their feelings were able to become a reality, then we were able to handle it. Then we were able to go to the next level with them.
Can I get the three of you, Cash, Sean and Noah, to come forward again? And can you actually, the three of you, do this mindful breathing for us quite close to where your microphone is, and then we can actually hear you doing it?
In our mindfulness and breathing exercise practice, we'll be doing the ocean sounding breath.
The ocean sounding breath is when you breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth with a whisper.
Now we will begin.
One.
Think of your emotions.
Two.
Think of the things that block you in life.
Three. Four.
Think of yourself.
Five.
Your loved ones.
Six.
The people that make you happy.
Seven.
Your family and friends.
Eight.
Your teachers.
Nine.
And yourself.
Ten. That concludes the ocean sounding breath.
That does sound rather relaxing. We were hearing there from pupils Cash, Sean and Noah, and before them, Lena Gates, principal of Brooklyn's Public School Number 5. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Javed Gilani. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Claire Graham.
And I'm the BBC World Affairs editor, John Simpson.
And we'd like to tell you about a new podcast from the BBC World Service, The Explanation.
The Explanation looks beyond the headlines, bringing you in-depth analysis of the stories affecting our lives.
Whether it's important, long-running issues,
or the latest global events,
we're making sense of the big stories
and giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.